You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 13th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Rich Yselson, writer of the piece Fortress Unionism in the Democracy Journal. Also on the program today, more on the NSA leaks. A congresswoman tells us we have just seen only the tip of the iceberg. Supreme Court rulings beginning to flow. Over the next 2 weeks, we will hear about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. We will hear about DOMA, California's hate legislation. Today, the Supreme Court says you cannot patent genes. There's some things you can patent, though. And I'm not talking about clothing. So that's good news for everyone who is worried that their bodily functions would involve a license fee. Also, sad news for Rush Limbaugh and all Republicans. Whites dying faster than they can be made. That's right. That's the story. I don't know
why that was funny. Whites being made.
Genteel
sweatshops.
We get very scientific here.
Cannot produce whites fast enough. Good news if you are a human being living in Connecticut. Connecticut is now the second state in the country, or is primed to be, I should say, the second state in the country which will pass the Homeless Persons Bill of Rights. The bill, SB 896, adds homeless people as a protected class who cannot be discriminated against in employment, housing, or public accommodations. The bill has seven protections. One, they may move freely in public spaces. Two, have equal opportunities for employment. Three, receive emergency medical care. Four, register to vote. And to vote. Five, have personal information protected. Six, have reasonable expectation of privacy in his or her personal property. And seven, receive equal treatment by state and municipal agencies. Now, basically what this says is that you cannot be denied these things if you lose your home. So we're not protecting a unique class of people, per se. We're protecting all people who, in the event that they lose their home for whatever reason and must sleep on the streets, cannot be subjected on that basis to some form of discrimination by either the state or private entities when it comes to employment or when it comes to voting, or an expectation that privacy, et cetera, et cetera. The bill is now awaiting Governor Dan Malloy's signature. Once he signs it, it is scheduled to take effect on October 1st, 2013. Like I say, Connecticut is now poised to be the second state in the country with such a bill of rights for people who lose their homes and have no homes. Rhode Island is the first, and it's possible we'll see something similar in Illinois and Oregon and Delaware, which are considering similar legislation. So good news in that accord. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Rich Yeselson about his piece in the Democracy Journal, Fortress Unionism. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Rich Yeselson. He has written a piece in the Democracy, a journal of ideas entitled Fortress Unionism. Rich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right. So let's. Your piece is wonderful, and it brought up a lot of points for me as I read it, and let's just start. You basically, I mean, the piece functions in a couple of different ways for me. You give a history of the Taft-Hartley Act and its implications for unions, and simultaneously also express to those of us who did not live in an era of when unions were so crucial to American workers and, frankly, to the vast majority of Americans, even if they weren't in a union. You give a sense of just how powerful they were. Let's go back and tell us what were the situations for unions prior to Taft-Hartley? How did it come about? Walk us through this.
Well, Taft-Hartley came about following the Second World War. This was a point where, of course, because of the total war effort, which was required by both American workers and their companies to produce the wherewithal of war, the guns, the bullets, the uniforms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the tanks. American workers were expected to have maximum uninterrupted production. In return for that, FDR's administration essentially squeezed employers and, compelled them to pretty much do what workers wanted. And what workers wanted was to have unions. And they wanted that all through the 30s, too. And they had fought sometimes at the risk of their lives, sometimes at the loss of their lives in the 30s to have those unions. So between the 30s, the Depression era of worker militancy, and then the World War II moment of the state helping unions collectively bargain and get contracts with companies, you had basically a third of American non-farm workers were unionized at the end of World War II.
And this was a function. I'm sorry. So the National Labor Relations Act passes in 1935, and that like almost quadrupled the number of union members.
No, that's what's fascinating. That, I mean, yes and no, but the it doesn't really quadruple them. The Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, is an expression of worker power more than the cause of it. In 1934, there was just massive eruptions of worker militants all over the country. A general strike in San Francisco, where basically 100,000 workers in San Francisco more controlled the city for 4 days. Where some of FDR's aides were asking him to like take a battleship into San Francisco Bay and threaten the workers in order to restore civil authority to the city. The Minnesota truckers' strike, with basically just violence all over Minneapolis, which resulted in like a huge gain for the Teamsters. 400,000 textile workers going on strike throughout mostly the South, but some in the North. Who lost their strike, the only major strike of that period to lose. So basically, the militants produces the act, and then the act only just inspires workers to do more. It doesn't so much enable them, but it just sort of like they're full of themselves now. They're like, yes, we have the support of the state, but it's the other way around. The power causes the act, not the act causes the power.
Didn't the act in some way, though, I mean, provide like it sort of, I guess, greased the wheels, as it were? I mean, it created a sort of an ability for the unions to grow. I mean, obviously, they grew significantly.
But again, I touched on this a bit in the article, but, you know, most of it was post-war.
Right.
But one of the things I wanted to at least try to convey about the act, because, yes, what you're saying is what I think most people, they thought about this at all, grow up with. It's kind of, I wouldn't even say it's the conventional historical interpretation, because I don't think, you know, sophisticated historians and economic historians believe this. But most people, they thought about, say, hey, there's this act. Labor's Magna Carta, it was called. And so then the workers organized. But what the act did was basically just empower workers to be more militant. They actually, most of them, even following the act, didn't use the mechanisms of the act to organize. In other words, didn't use the National Labor Relations Board to have elections. Even following the act, the easiest way to organize would just try to squeeze 100 people into the boss's office and say, hey, we want a union, but to ring the company with pickets. And because workers' power was so overwhelming, so potent at that time, and because nobody back then would cross a picket line, the company, the boss would just say, yes, you have a union. And that's how it was done, even though the act permitted a mechanism to allow it to be done.
So
that's how powerful the militancy was. And it's hard for us to grasp that today because, frankly, it's so different.
So, I guess another way to look at it is this is just something they had in their back pocket. This is their fallback position at that point.
And that empowered them. Right. It was a cultural power, yes. I mean, what it did do was say, for all time and place, codified in law, you, the American worker, have a right under law to collectively bargain, famously under Section 7A, to collectively bargain. The mechanism didn't matter so much as the cultural power imbued in it. And that's part of what Taft-Hartley rolled back, was that cultural power.
All right, so let's talk. So, in some respects, it's also, we can view the National Labor Relations Act as almost a way of appeasing the labor movement at that time. We sometimes view Social Security as a similar appeasement for the agitation that was happening for an even more expansive retirement program, I guess.
No question. I mean, the nice word would say, you know, like American citizens, American workers, you know, won these rights from the states by pressuring the state. Yes.
As opposed to blackmail, but I mean that's the way our process works. I mean, in many respects, it's I'm going to ask for a lot, and you give me, I'll settle for 10% less or whatever it is. And so, okay, so
right, exactly.
So we go through now following, and this is the thing that I think sort of really, I don't know, I found really struck me was as soon as the war ends, there is massive, massive labor upheaval. You there?
Oh, no. I lost.
Hello?
Hello? Oh, you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. Wow. I'm sorry, Sam. I think I lost you there for a second.
Okay, that's fine. So as soon as the war ends, there is, and I was saying this, I was really struck by just the numbers that you were talking about, and just sort of, I just don't know that I was aware of just how intense the militancy was. But as soon as the war ends, literally hundreds of thousands of workers go on strike.
Yes, it's millions. It's mind-boggling by today's standards, by any standards. And that's why, because of that, that's why labor management relations, the power of what was truly then, in the United States context, big labor. That's the joke, the Wall Street Journal, big labor. I mean, it's no longer. But back then, it is mind-boggling, the power of workers to collectively bargain and to withdraw their labor when they were unhappy with conditions at work. And basically what you see is a kind of a dual, somewhat contradictory anxiety happening in the workforce following the end of World War II. On one hand, there's a fear, because basically, remember, it's end of 1945, beginning 46, just had this incredible, unprecedented depression following the war. Then we get full employment with the war, the biggest Keynesian stimulus of all time, under 2% unemployment. But the war's over, so nobody knows. Wait a minute, are we going to go back to the 30s? Are we going to have bread lines again? Are we going to have 20-25% unemployment again? So on one hand, there's an anxiety about that. On the other hand, there's anxiety because there's wage price controls imposed by the government during the war. And there's a fear that, wait a minute, okay, when Truman said he was going to do this and eventually it happened, that's going to be ended. And basically, so prices will go up. So the workers have this anxiety, have this incredible anxiety about inflation. And they want to catch up to it. So the combination of those two fears at a point when unions were incredibly powerful generates a strike wave unprecedented in U.S. history, where 10% of the entire American non-farm workforce, 10%, went on strike in 1946.
Let me just, I want to read off some of the numbers that you cite in the piece, because it really, these numbers really sort of struck me. Between essentially in that year and a half period, 68,000 textile workers, 35,000 oil refinery workers, 40,000 lumber workers, 70,000 Teamsters, 100,000 workers in Oakland, which was I think the last general strike that maybe we've had in this country. I'm not sure. And
it's arguably true. Yes.
225.
There were several others that year, but yes.
225,000 auto workers. 350,000 mine workers, 750,000 steel workers struck for 25 days. At one point, 1.6 to 1.8 million workers were on strike. In this day and age, if we, based upon our population, that would be 14 million strikers striking in a single year. And this is so stunning because I'm following these stories of a half dozen cities where you've got 100 people in each city maybe striking against a, fast food restaurants right
fast
now.
Fast food places, right.
And
those are incredibly brave workers to do that.
Indeed. And what's fascinating about this, too, is that when we think about worker insecurity today, the response is almost the opposite of what it was at that time. I mean, it seems to me that the increased insecurity in the labor market actually disemboldens workers, or at least in this area that we're in now, it seems to me. But it had the complete opposite effect then.
Well, I mean, of course, there were some large differences, which helped to facilitate that emboldenment. And yes, for sure, things are different. I mean, for one thing, at that point, post-World War II, a third, maybe 35% of the non-farm workforce organized, which with even some southern states, particularly Alabama, which had a strong steel industry, having the kind of union density rates then that were low, say 18% of the workforce in Alabama was organized in like 1945,
wow.
46. But we now think that's actually the same number in Michigan today.
Right.
Which we think is a high number. And it is a high number, objectively, today. It's like fourth or fifth in the country. So what you had was, and most of those workers were in manufacturing and transportation and mining. And these were huge workforces. Again, that's part of it. Part of the size of the numbers has to do with just how big these industries are. Like 750,000 steel workers in 46. This is off my memory now, but I think today in the United States, there are about maybe a little bit under 200,000 steelworkers total. Not 200,000 unionized steelworkers, because most of the industry isn't unionized, or a good part of it isn't. But 200,000 steelworkers, period, in a country, you know, 2.5 times the size of population-wise of what it was in 1946. So these industries were much larger than they were then, and they were completely organized. They were wall-to-wall organized with workers who were, yes, did feel empowered because they were getting steady wages. Their working conditions had vastly improved. They had much more power to just tell their boss to F himself, or I was about to say herself, but they were all the bosses
right.
were hims back then,
right.
pretty much. So these are, yes, these are very empowered workers who have strong institutions behind them, who had complete organizational control of enormous industries. That's, you know, compare that to fast food today. I mean, obviously, it's no comparison at all, right?
And the other,
it's that bless those workers.
Indeed. And the other thing you point out, too, is that there was not just density within industries and density within states. There was literally a close proximity in terms of you had hundreds, if not thousands, of people working like physically close to each other, as opposed to, you know, when we talk about the Walmart strikes, you know, the most you have employees working in any given Walmart is 300 people. But if you've got 5,000 yeah. people working in a factory, things are going to spread, you know, in a much, much more, I guess, rapid fashion.
Right. Right. The key kind of comparison I make there, which you're alluding to, is the one between what was then the dominant industry in the country, which was making cars, and what today is the dominant company in the country, Walmart, a retail company, which has 1.4 million workers, you know, about 1% of all the workers in the United States, non-farm workers, when they're working, allowing for unemployment, work at a Walmart, which is, you know, in itself remarkable. It was pretty much the same in the automobile industry writ large, all the car companies, GM, Ford, the ones that have now faded, Chrysler, Studebaker, et cetera, maybe a little more than 1%, maybe 1.2% worked in as auto workers back then. But they weren't in, like, you know, your average Walmart store, 200 workers, 300 workers. There's 4,200 of them around the country. They were in these huge plants. You know, the Flint, Michigan plant, you know, had, you know, close to 50,000 workers
wow.
at the time of the famous sit-down strike of 1937. You know, it expanded during wartime to something like 80,000, I think. I mean, so if you just so that's a GM plant. If you just organized Flint, one factory, but one with roughly 50,000 workers, you've organized a substantial percentage of all of the GM workers in the United States. If you just organized one Walmart, actually, probably in terms of like employer resistance, the militant like anti-unionism of the company itself, it's the same. GM hated the union. Walmart hated the union, would do anything to stop a union. But at the end of the day, if you've accomplished this amazing thing of organizing one Walmart, you've got 300 workers
right.
out of 1.4 million. I should correct that slightly. It's 1.4 million workers, including supervisors, but
right.
still, 300 workers is a lot different than 47,000 at Flint.
Okay, so now that takes us to the backlash. There becomes an awareness that the unions and labor have become incredibly powerful as a function of all these things. And you know, one of the things that maybe we'll save for another day is also sort of the national background. I mean, there was a lot of ideas that were still floating around because from immigration from Europe that I think fed
mm-hmm.
into sort of the what emboldened people and just their perception of what could be done in terms of unions. But let's leave that aside for a moment and go to the backlash. And you write that there was a coalition in Congress between Republicans and Southern Democrats who were afraid of an alliance between labor and a nascent African American civil rights movement. Talk about how that congealed that backlash and Taft-Hartley, which came from it.
Right. Well, you're right. You have. I mean, here's what's fascinating. I mean, just step back for a second. Here's what's fascinating about this apex of union power, right? Which, wow, 35%. I mean, you know, private sector unionization, like it's 6.5% today, right? It's kind of a difference. And so it's big labor is really big, but the backlash is correspondingly bigger, you know? So basically what you've got is, on one hand, Republicans who reflexively, you know, going back to the days of the Liberty League in the 1930s, led by DuPont, they just hate unions because unions upset and disrupt the prerogatives of capital, of management, Okay? So they would hate unions no matter what. The South, the Southern white power bloc in Congress and within Southern society, hey, it's more complicated. At the beginning, actually, most Southerners voted for the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. They were still part of the New Deal coalition then. Even some of the biggest racists voted for it. What happened was African-American prerogatives, assertiveness increases. African-American soldiers come back from World War II, like smart, confident men like Medgar Evers. Come back to their home states of Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and Georgia and South Carolina and say, you know, we fought for this country and now we're being treated like second-class citizens. Sorry, not good enough. Like I'm going to, you know, maybe I'm going to talk to some of my friends and my family, and we're going to try to do what's right here. We're going to change this country, and that's what freaks out the Southern power bloc, because at that point, and these are Democrats, but they are terrified that unions will come in, organize both black and white low-wage workers, and completely disrupt like the kind of like low-wage system of economic exploitation that they had established for decades in the white supremacist South. So that's where you have the linkages between the Southern Democrats and essentially the entire Republican Party, with one or two kind of, you know, somewhat maverick exceptions. Wayne Morse was one of them, the famous Oregon senator who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, was reasonably pro-union. But he was the exception that proved the rule. That combination is overwhelming, especially when added to, like, everybody else. I mean, every other power elite in this society. The media, you know, I mean, what, you know, of course, you know, it was different then. It was mostly big newspapers, but every major publisher hates unions. They all hate them, you know. Big business, obviously, is dealing with unions. The big steel, big oil, big coal.
What was the public? I mean, was the backlash? I understand that, you know, from obviously the media is feeding this, et cetera, but what was the public generally, where was the public generally on this?
This is actually a fascinating empirical question. I mean, on one hand, of course, I mean, one of the problems is, and of course, the polling was not nearly as sophisticated and constant as polling today. And in fact, like a friend of mine, a political scientist at the University of Michigan, just last night sent me some articles that colleagues of his have written about public opinion about unions in this period. I wish I'd had them at the time I'd written the article, and I haven't read them yet. I got them about 11:30 last night. But so we have to infer public opinion. There were some polls which showed, you know, relatively close between, hey, are you on the union side or are you on the employer side? But on balance, you have to say that it pretty much broke down, like in terms of like the large forces of society, pretty much the way the vote for the Taft-Hartley bill did in Congress ultimately, 2-1. I mean, you had organized, unionized workers, a lot of, you know, the white workers, the ethnic Catholics, African Americans, mostly situated in the Northeast and the Midwest, although, as I said, even the South was more organized than today. California and the West Coast was also well organized. And then against that, you had every other sector of society. I mean, small town America, which Robert Taft represented perfectly in the South, you know, the America of Sinclair Lewis and Babbitt, say, or Sherwin Anderson in Winesburg, Ohio. They didn't like unions. Unions were other, were different.
Right.
Small businesses were terrified of unions. They weren't mostly organized, hardly at all, but they didn't want to be. You know, big business had the unions, but wished someone could just wave a magic wand and make them all go away. So it's very tricky to figure out exactly what public opinion was.
All right. Well,
I tend to think, I mean, I'll have to read these articles and see what they say. I tend to think it pretty much breaks down probably a very strong, assertive third to 40% supporting unions and an almost equally strong, assertive 60% opposed. But I cannot swear to that, and maybe 10 scholars who listen to this will disagree with me.
Okay, so nevertheless, Taft-Hartley passes.
With the security, national security officials about this surveillance program.
I don't know. Hold on.
By Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian, there's more.
What?
Sam, I'm getting some.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. Hold on for 1 second. Sorry.
The officials asked about that. How are they planning to respond?
It's not coming from me.
What we learned in there.
Hello? Sorry.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, sorry, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, I had no idea either. Okay.
So Taft-Hartley passes. It not only passes, it is able to sustain a veto override a veto, Truman's veto. And so it imposes, it basically begins the slow. Is this what accounts for? And we're talking just about private unionization, private sector unionization. But what are the elements of Taft-Hartley that essentially begin to unwind unions?
Well, again, it's fascinating because at first they didn't unwind so much. Like union density declined a little bit for the next 20 years or so. But What Taft-Hartley did was prevent unions from growing more. It stopped their forward advance, and it did that in several ways. First, of course, we talked on this show before about right to work laws.
Yes.
Essentially, it became much more difficult for unions to organize because Taft-Hartley allowed states to opt out of closed shop unions, where, if you joined the union, you were simply required because you were going to get services in return, so this seemed reasonable, to pay union dues. I mean, it forced the union to, try to persuade workers to pay union dues, even though they weren't required to pay union dues, which is a hard sell.
Right.
And the South immediately, almost the day after the law was passed, almost every Southern state passed right-to-work laws. And in fact, some of them had actually passed them earlier. They were unconstitutional. Like in Arkansas, they passed one.
And they were just waiting.
Like 44, 45. But it couldn't even go into effect until Taft-Hartley happened.
Okay.
So that was one big thing. But then there were a lot – most people know about that one. But then there were, subtle things that happened that people don't realize. Like, there was actually a movement of, foremen to be in unions. At this time, hundreds of thousands of sort of middle management, you would say, or would you, people between the boss and the workers on the floor joined their own kind of organization. And it was a proto-union, and it was very sympathetic to real unions. And basically, Taft-Hartley made these proto-unions illegal. And that's, to
just
this
the
day,
construction,
that
just
affects
the,
who can organize.
Just
like
the
private sector. Professors in universities are now considered "quote unquote" supervisors.
Right, just the construction
and they do not have the
of
right
the
to organize,
just the construction
that
of the,
comes out of Taft-Hartley.
Just the construction of the concept of middle management. Already, sort of, you've drawn that line. Perhaps you've created a battle line. Maybe, sort of, you've pushed it closer to the workers. In other words. By middle management, we know whose side they're going to be on by their nomenclature, but in reality, they may not really be management in that sense.
Right. And another big one, I just have to mention, because it's really so important in today's context and going forward, and again, it was like a slow-acting poison for labor, was sort of codifying. There have been some court decisions about this, but the Taft-Hartley codified the right of the employer, of the boss, to have "quote unquote" free speech. In other words, in most countries in the world to this day, in Western Europe, in parts of Canada—not all, but parts of the provinces of Canada, most advanced countries—it's the workers' decision, right or wrong, for better or for worse, to self-organize and choose their own collective bargaining agent. After the workers decide whether they want a union or not, then the company steps in and bargains with them. And the company can bargain hard and can be belligerent and tough and protect their rights, but they're not involved in the actual election or decision of the workers. Taft-Hartley said, no, companies, as long as they don't do a few things which are totally outrageous, but which they actually turned out to do anyway because the law is so weak in remedying this. Taft-Hartley says, no, companies, the people who write the checks of the workers, have the right to sort of stick their head into the argument about whether to have a union. In other words, the people who have the most self-interest and who the workers realize that if they antagonize, they might lose their job are the ones saying, hey, don't have a union.
Right. It's not even necessarily the people who have the most self-interest. It's also the people who have the most leverage in that relationship.
Exactly. That was huge. And these things over time powerfully eroded, and several others powerfully eroded the power of unions.
And I wanted to also just mention, which I found fascinating because I didn't know about, and it was actually, repealed in 1965 by the Supreme Court, but unions were forced to sign a non-communist affidavit, which basically said that you all have to attest there's no communists in your union, which it's bizarre, but it had the impact of basically of what a wedge issue in today's parlance.
Yes, this was like just a slight correction. The core staff, officers, et cetera, not so much attest that they weren't communists, but attest that they personally, from the president of the union on down, was not a communist. But which was just as burdensome, and to the credit of most union officers, even the ones who were rabidly, as many were, anti-communist, like John L. Lewis, they just found this to be, we're talking about, this is in the context of talking about civil liberties today with the NSA issues, et cetera. Americans are thinking about these issues. They found this wildly, unconstitutional, a complete violation of their civil liberties, that they had to basically sign a loyalty oath in order to continue to have standing before the National Labor Relations Board. Now, actually, and ironically, a great liberal hero and truly a great labor leader, and I believe on balance a great man, Walter Reuther, was supportive of it because he was fighting a communist faction within the United Auto Workers. But basically, this was a wedge issue because, again, hard to imagine, but, maybe 7-8% of union membership at the time weren't communist-affiliated, even dominated unions. And that meant they were associated with the Communist Party of the United States in some way or another. And in a sense, that didn't matter so much for foreign policy. I mean, these were militant unions. They were usually the cutting-edge unions that supported African-American civil rights at this time. They were aggressive militant unions in the American political and economic context. And to drive that wedge, based on, the issues of the day, foreign policy, the menace of the Soviet Union, et cetera, separated these militant unions from their unions that, in fact, they had been working with, there was some tension, but reasonably collegially as a movement, especially within the CIO. And then eventually the CIO, and this was a huge story at the time in 1950, just expelled all of its communist-affiliated unions, and just said, "You're out of here." And this kind of derives from the anti-communist affidavit clause of Taft-Hartley.
And so you describe also one of the things about Taft-Hartley is that it forced the unions to become more bureaucratized, and in some ways, sort of. The bureaucracy, just having to deal with all the implications and all the laws and being in compliance and strategizing based upon these roadblocks that are set up by Taft-Hartley sort of diminishes and I would imagine also just sort of not only diminishes the options on the table, but it means that the leadership of these organizations have to change just in terms of personality types as to who would be the people in that organization who have, who end up being the leaders in some respects. I mean,
And in fact, you know, it's interesting you mention that because the famous iconoclast leftist sociologist C. Wright Mills wrote his first book about the labor movement in 1947, and he called it The New Men of Power. And basically what he's trying to say is, even then in 1947, that these, right, the presidents of the unions then, when again unions were at their zenith, were becoming more careful, more calculating, less militant. And yes, just as you say, everything became lawyered up. And we see this in the labor movement today. I worked in the labor movement for a long time. And the lawyers are just doing their job. It's nothing against them. But basically, you know, everybody sort of is cautious and says, can we do this? And then a lawyer comes in and says, well, probably not. You'll probably get sued, or maybe here's a way around it. But remember what I was saying about how unions were organized and how worker power expressed itself in the 30s. You just get dozens of guys in the boss's office.
Right.
And say, damn it, we've had enough.
Right, and
you
this
know,
is,
we want a union.
This is
well,
a dynamic that I think you
the
can
lawyer
see.
Whether that was legal or
this
not.
Is, this is
that
a
was
dynamic.
Just like the, you know, that was just the employer then saying that was just a power relationship within civil society,
right.
Like two big arms having an arm wrestle. And that was the labor arm being, for a time, at least as strong and in some certain contexts, even stronger than the employer. But now all that went away. Now it was like, you know, let's check the law, let's check the regs.
And we should say, this is...
And unions, I think, lost their edge. And that happened over time, too. Again, it was a ticking time bomb that Taft hardly triggered.
And I would say, Rich, this is a dynamic that you see, you could apply this to any really sort of organizations or groups. I mean, this is the same stuff that happens with entrepreneurial, you know, in situations. And this just happened sort of... in a rather than a narrow group subset, this happened to a whole sector of sorts. Okay, so let's skip ahead here because and talk about what fortress unionism is and why you think that this is really the only option for unions now.
Well, first I want to, I mean, with genuine modesty, say, you know, who knows? I'm sort of making a guess. I'm throwing it out there. You know, I expect, I hope people will contest, revise, criticize. But basically what I'm saying is, if you look at the, not just the history of how unions really build large increases in their membership in the United States, but all over the Western world, all over, Western Europe, Canada, I mean, it only happens in two ways. I mean, it either happens in the way I described at the outset, where under the conditions of world war, and I'm sorry, not even like Vietnam, not even like medium-sized wars, Korea or, you know, Iraq, they don't count. It has to be like total war mobilization. And World War I, and even more so in World War II, the state steps in and says, we need you to build guns 24/7, and in return you'll get a union. And what you give us in return is you don't strike. But you get your union because we can't afford your strikes, but you get a union. So that helps. And then the other thing that helps is, or that happens, is that in times of real social unrest, the unrest is generated primarily by the workers. Like, it's not a question of, like, some smart union strategist. They can help, but it's not like, okay, here's a great idea, and we'll go in and organize the work. It's like workers... you know, just say, you know, and they generate their own leaders, you know, their indigenous leaders within their own community, within their own workforce, and say, you know, we've had enough, and we're not going to ask the lawyers what to think. And then the unions, smartly, if they are being smart, play catch-up. And then the unions say, let's bring in organizers. They're raising holy hell at that big factory, you know. Let's catch up to that, and let's see if we can channel that. Let's see if we can get these people to join our union and institutionalize this. That's how it happens. So I think, like, my idea of fortress unionism is to, like, try to, like, train leadership cadre for the future, which some AFL-CIO programs are doing. Try to beef up and maintain like kind of defensive bulwarks in the places where unions still are strong, like in the city of Las Vegas, where like the casino workers union called the culinary workers, part of Unite Here, the national union, is the most powerful local union in the United States that basically has incredible weight both economically and politically in that city. And just, you know, that's the difference between New Orleans and Las Vegas as big tourist cities. I mean, leaving aside, you know, the various, you know, the hurricane and things that happened in New Orleans, just as a tourist city, is that Las Vegas has unions and workers, you know, can live a middle-class life in Las Vegas based on their union salary, and that doesn't happen for hotel workers in New Orleans. So I say beef up and maintain the power of a place like that. Maintain the power of the Latino labor connection there and in Los Angeles. Cities like Seattle have incredibly strong union density, still New York City. Certain industries like telecommunications, certain companies, UPS, still is a bulwark of unionism. Make sure we keep those, but don't kind of start like sort of big top-down comprehensive campaigns at this point, because we've done that for 30 years. A few of them work, but on balance, you know, the union densities keep going down. So it's not a successful tactic, I don't believe.
Because, you know, what you're describing here, which is essentially, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's essentially protect what exists, be patient, build an infrastructure, strengthen existing strongholds, and wait. And
yes.
Capitalize as organic eruptions occur. And you talk about that union membership spikes at certain times and then recedes a little bit, but all the gains are made through spikes. And the fascinating thing about this is that, you know, in the course of, like, I see that with just our listeners on this program. You know, I mean, that is the way, and from everything that I have read in terms of, like, the way that the internet works, which is, you know, sort of nothing but just sort of a data machine, is that, you know, that's the way sites catch fire. It's a spike. It levels off. You stay at that plateau. It spikes and on. And
think of hot restaurants.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Somebody hears of some hot restaurant in Park Slope in Brooklyn or in some Los Angeles neighborhood, you know, and next thing you know, right, it spikes. You know?
What's interesting to me too is that, you know, I recently spoke to Bhaskar Sankara in part on his piece that was in The Nation, but
yes.
We talked about strategically, you know, the way that he perceives radicals should move forward. And it's in many respects very similar in terms of a strategy. The idea being that you need to be aware of the power that you have at this time. You don't want to overextend yourself, but rather build infrastructure, build relationships on what exists now, and wait for the opportunity. And it's just fascinating to me to see sort of like that.
Frustrating to people, understandably.
Absolutely. But
why,
I wonder,
you know,
what is it?
You know, people want to make something big happen. If you're a union staff person, if you're, you know, you want to, hey, damn it, let's break the strictures of history. Let's not be fatalistic. And I'm not arguing for people to be fatalistic. I'm arguing for people to be strategic.
And patient. And patient, I guess.
And patient.
And because, you know. Reading your piece, it just brought up the same memory that I had when I was talking to Bhaskar, which was that I can't remember what episode it was, but it was in Mad Men when Betty, Don's wife, hears from Henry that strategy of just wait until you have the power, patience to make your move, and. I wonder, what do you think it is that's in the air now that is because I've spoken to other sort of people who have this sort of same notion of what needs to be done, who are not necessarily representing the same movements per se, but that there's something in the air that is basically saying people need to take not necessarily a retreat, but an entrenchment and wait, and wait for the opportunity. What do you think it is that's going on right now that brings different people to that conclusion, particularly those who are looking for some type of social change?
Well, I you know, several things. You know, obviously this is, like, as they say, overdetermined by many factors. But, you know, essentially, and it becomes circular. What's the cause and what's the effect here? But, you know, essentially you don't have, you know, which left thought tried to extol and promote for over a century. You don't have what's called a historical agent of change. You know, first it was the working class. And, you know, then there were different ones. There were, you know, in the 60s, people extolled students as the new agent of change. People extolled third world revolutionaries like Ho Chi Minh and Castro as the revolutionary agents of change. Women, to some degree, became a revolutionary agent of change through second wave feminism. And what we see is, you know, we see sparks of movements. We see certainly the power of the gay and lesbian movement to be very precise about a very, very important social advance, human rights advance, the right to same-sex marriage. But that's a key reform. It's not a transcendent change. And people which a lot of people on the left have, who grew up reading histories of at least attempts at transcendent change, it takes them a while to sort of get to the point where they look around and they say, my God, we elected an African-American guy, like, who, you know, whose father was Kenyan, who grew up in part in Indonesia, and his name is Barack Hussein Obama. And, like, you know, the world didn't change because of that. I mean, there have been some substantive differences, but, you know, this was, you know, America can accommodate that. You know, and so you need, you know, I don't know who knows what the spark is, but there needs to be kind of a realistic kind of understanding of that. You know, the old optimism of the will, but pessimism of the intellect.
Right.
Gramsci quoted a French poet to say.
Well, so just in closing, give me a guess. I mean, where do you think this, I mean, do you have any sense? I mean, because in my mind, when I think about what will be potential agents of change going forward, I have two broad guesses. One is a change in demographics in this country in some fashion, and really just sort of the reactionary forces embracing an old an old demographic, literally a dying demographic. The other being climate. That is going to disrupt the normal order of such that we need, you know, whatever movement at the time is most functional and will be able to step in at that time, assuming the best, I guess, in terms of the way that the establishment reacts to this. But, I mean, what would you be your guesses?
Yes, I very much agree with you about the increasing change in the demographics, where you basically have various forces on the liberal left, feminism, human rights activists of various kinds, still labor activists, pushing against a whole kind of coherent wave of post-60s anti-modernity, people who kind of wish the 60s never happened. And want to roll back and have a tremendous amount of cultural anxiety about difference, and social anxiety about the quote-unquote America they have lost. Now, what you see with these Latino labor strongholds like L.A., you know, second largest city in the country, Las Vegas, you see workers coming up from Central America and Mexico who have come out of leftist backgrounds in those countries and are used to taking risks. You know, there's like an old joke about, it actually happened, about like a, you know, an organizer for Justice for Janitors telling, you know, Central American workers, listen, you may lose your job. This is going to be a tough fight. We'll do our best, but you might get fired. And the worker, this is true, and the worker started laughing at the organizer. He said, why are you laughing? He said, getting fired. That's easy. You know, we come from Guatemala. You know, everybody was getting killed. Okay, we can do that. We can get fired. No problem. So I think the Latino change is augurs well. As far as climate change goes, I agree. It's actually the Great Depression times 5 or 10 in terms of like the possibility of just society-wide transformation. The question is, when it really starts to affect people, will it be too late to actually, you know, structurally roll back what's already happened? Like, right. So then we have the larger question, not just of the strategic ascension of one side over the other in the political battles and the ideological battles, but, you know, right, actually sustaining and saving the planet. But I actually agree with, I think you've actually hit it. I think if you were going to guess, those are the two big ones.
All right. Well, Rich Yselson, the piece we have it linked at majority.fm, I really appreciate you taking the time today. Really fascinating stuff.
Thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate you giving me the time.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Boop, boop. When we come back, we're going to play you this sound from a congresswoman who apparently was briefed on the what the NSA is doing, and she seems rather shocked. I think the word she used was stunning, and it may be a slight indication of what is to come, as we know that Glenn Greenwald and Snowden have more to offer us.
She might listen to this show, actually, with her use of the word stunning.
I don't know if she's trying to send us a signal.
I think if she says unbelievable in her next appearance, it will
then
be
we
clear
know.
That
yeah.
it's a majority.
I don't know. I can't say for sure that she isn't trying to signal us. Maybe that she's just attempting to get booked on the show. But we will take a break. We'll come back. We will talk about that. We will talk about the data that supports the notion that a big demographic change is headed our way. I'm sorry, Rush Limbaugh, but apparently whites are just not having enough babies, and they're just dying.
We got this great Sean Hannity clip that shows.
Yes. Which mirrored, actually, the random Rush we did yesterday.
Yes.
And good news for those of you who thought you'd have to pay a license fee when you went to the bathroom. Apparently, jeans cannot be patented. I'm not talking about jeans in terms of pants. I used to make that joke about every time you go take a leak, you got to pay Monsanto 10 cents because of your Monsanto bladder. All right, folks, become a member today at majority.fm. It is your support that makes this show possible. The show is not possible without your support. I don't know that a 45-minute or 50-minute long discussion of union power in this country, how it waned, and what it should do now to set itself up for the future is your cup of tea. But if it is, guess what? You ain't getting it anywhere else. I've seen many tea shops fail in this city. But, so this may not be the best business model, but I certainly enjoy it. And if you find those type of things interesting and worthwhile, understand that you are SOL if this show is not supported and able to go forward. Because I don't know where else you get that. Anybody? Matt? Michael?
Nope.
No. You can find other hosts who know that guy, Saif Rojif, or whatever the guy who was in the Transformers.
Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah.
Did you just call him Seth Rojif?
I couldn't remember his name.
You were thinking of Seth Rogen.
Or, yeah, well, I know who Seth
now,
Rogen.
Now, I would be excited to see a Transformers with Seth Rogen carrying that vehicle. That would be a much more interesting movie.
I'd be excited to meet someone named Seth Rogen.
My point being that you can find plenty of outlets that will give you an update on him, Shia LaBeouf. But you're just not going to hear what you hear on this program. So if you can become a member, please do. Majority.fm. If you buy crap through Amazon and you are not buying it through our link, take a look at yourself in the mirror. Aren't you slightly embarrassed? You can do nothing and still support the program. All you got to do, well, it's not nothing, but it's virtually nothing. It costs you nothing. It costs you not even 5 minutes of your time. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, see the Amazon box, click it, bookmark it. Whenever you buy through something through Amazon, you will notice no difference. It doesn't matter if you're a Prime member, you're not a Prime member, none of it. Just if you start with that link, you bookmark it, and you go through there, anything you buy, we get a small kickback. It's not a ton of money, but it's something. And it doesn't cost you anything, and it deprives Amazon of some small percentage of their profits. So it's like a win-win-win-win-win.
Now you're talking to the audience.
There you go. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% coupon code, use the code MAJORITY. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, if you want to be a part of the program. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.